You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Xi Jinping is awarded by acclamation his own capital T thought, just like Chairman Mao. How far behind are the alarm clocks? My guests, Ivor Gaber and Jeffrey Howard, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the EU's suggestions that it's not too late for the UK to change its mind, the Bundestag's options for corralling its new cohort of cranky far-right yahoos, and is posting something stupid online half a lifetime ago a resigning issue now? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Jeffrey Howard, Lecturer in Political Theory at University College London. Welcome both. And we will start with what might be an offer from the European Union to help Britain bind the self-inflicted gunshot wounds fired into its feet last June 23rd. EU President Donald Tusk, speaking to the European Parliament, listed the UK's options as a good deal, no deal, or no Brexit. His remarks followed several months of inconclusive negotiations between the UK and the EU, as well as a call from the OECD for a second referendum, and spoken out loud suggestions from some British politicians, including London's Mayor Sadiq Khan, that such a vote might be necessary. Ivor, I wanted to start by looking at the three options that Tusk adumbrated there. The first, a good deal. Is that actually even on the table?
Well, I think in the present political climate, one should never say never about anything. We are in such uncertain times. But I have to say, if I was a betting man, I wouldn't touch it with an old pound note or pound coin.
Jeffrey, moving us then on to no deal, which there seems to be a certain amount of attempts to brace the United Kingdom for. Is that actually politically plausible?
I think it is plausible, but I think this faces a serious legitimacy concern. We have a faction of one of the political parties negotiating a once-in-a-generation transformative deal, and it's just unacceptable for such a major transformative deal, or lack thereof, if it turns out that there's not a deal, to be reached without all of the country coming together and deciding on a consensual vision. And in many ways, this traces back to one of the initial problems with Brexit itself. It was a constitutional-level change, and as a constitutional-level change, it really should have been the kind of thing that was up to a supermajority. We all should have come together as a country and insisted on something like a 70% rule. And because there are those legitimacy concerns, not just about the initial Brexit vote itself, but about whatever solution we arrive at, I think another vote is absolutely going to be necessary.
That first vote having been, of course, a vote for departure rather than destination. Ivor, that brings us on to the third and most intriguing option that Donald Tusk suggested, which was no Brexit. Now, realistically, is that doable? There is the unarguable case that a referendum was held and 52% of people who voted to leave. That politically does take some overcoming. It wouldn't be the first rerun of a referendum in the history of the EU, but it would be by far the most audacious and divisive.
Before I answer that question, as politicians are wont to say, can I just add, the reason I was so sceptical about no good deal being available is I was reminded recently from a friend who had just come back from Greenland, population 56,000, took them 7 years to negotiate a good deal to exit. Population UK 60 million, multiply whatever. So it's complicated, which is why I felt pretty unfortunately confident saying no good deal. But can Brexit be stopped? Well, of course it can, because what man does, man can undo, to make a sexist typology. But and this notion Article 50 is legal legally binding is clearly been shown to be A, legally not correct. The man in the UK diplomat, in fact, who negotiated, who drew it up, said, no, it can be undone. And of course, politically, all the signs from Tusk, from Macron, from Merkel are saying if Britain wants to step back, because it's going to damage the EU as well. So legally and in diplomatic terms, it's possible. But the big difficulty is in terms of UK politics. Now, I declare an interest. I'm a passionate Remainer. There is a problem if, in terms of British democracy, if you like, if you go back and say, well, that vote you just took in 2016, we are going to either ignore it or ask you to vote again or Parliament's take a decision, it could damage our democracy, which is in a pretty fragile state. Having said that, I personally believe that's a risk worth taking because I think the consequences of Brexit will be so bad. So, yes, it could be. Can I just add, I think it also depends on, obviously, in terms of what happens to the Conservative part, the Conservative government. The Mrs. May, the Prime Minister, is, and she's not hanging on by a thread. I think that's the wrong analogy. She's being desperately propped up by her MPs and her ministers to keep her there. And they want to keep her there for two reasons. One, to avoid yet another catastrophic general election. And secondly, she's, if we get the bad deal that unfortunately I anticipate, she's the fool guy who's going to take responsibility. And a year before the next general election, she'll have her legs chopped off and they'll say, well, that was all Mrs. May's fault, but we're new leadership and we're going to do it well. So yes, it is possible. Is it likely at this stage? Not.
Geoffrey, it strikes me at least that a key move or thing that needs to shift to make a second referendum happen needs to be one of Britain's major political parties, which, let's face it, is going to have to be the opposition Labour Party, actually coming out and saying that we want a second referendum. But before they feel confident or legitimate in doing that, how much more does opinion need to shift? Because the kind of interesting thing is that the polls are not really budging. For all that the negotiations have been disorganised, that the government is in disarray and so forth, every poll does not really yet suggest any detectable amount of buyer's remorse.
I think we're going to move a bit closer to the precipice before the opinion's going to start to shift. We're going to need to start looking over that chasm and realizing just how bad a bad deal or even no deal is going to be before you start getting people suggesting that maybe we do need to reconsider what's happened here. I mean, I think it's true that if the government unilaterally decided, you know what, we're going to ignore the referendum, we're not going to pursue Brexit, I completely agree with Ivor that that would be damaging to a democracy. So if we decided not to go through with Brexit, that would need to be democratically authorized. But I think that you could envision us getting to a place where you had majority support for the kind of referendum whereby we could take a look at what was going to happen and decide whether we wanted to go through with Brexit. And of course, Brexiters are going to respond by suggesting that that itself is anti-democratic because we decided at the referendum that we were going to have Brexit. But part of what it is to be a democracy is that you get to change your mind.
Ivor, you made a reference earlier to the slightly fragile and precarious state of Britain's democracy. Is that likely to get worse? There's a general sense, I think, or at least it's one I perceive, that Brexit is sending this country somewhat insane. And there's a small glimmer of which we saw today with the release or leakage of this letter from an MP called Chris Heaton-Harris, a junior and, dare one say, irrelevant MP, but nevertheless asking universities for details of who is teaching what about Brexit. Now, the reaction from Britain's institutes of higher education has been to, I think, to use a very British expression, to cite the precedent of Arkell v. Prestram, which our curious listeners can look up later. But where the heck does this come from? I mean, it's a really odd thing to do.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, A, you have to recognise that this MP, whose name already escapes me, but is a member of an extreme pro-Brexit campaign group. And I can see how excitedly one day they said, what can we do next to make sure it's those so-and-sos in our universities? Let's send them a letter. And they got terribly excited about it and carried away. And the letter, though, you're absolutely right, Andrew, there is a bit of madness about it. It is extremely sinister. I think it's extremely sinister. Universities in this country are proudly independent. They exist under a royal charter. They are not beholden to government interference, let alone backbench interference. And I do think that Brexit has slightly unhinged the political classes. And I think that, particularly in the Conservative Party, but on the other hand, this is nothing new. That Europe has been a poison running through the veins of the Conservative Party for the last 30, 40 years, in fact, since the Second World War. Labour has its own divisions, but it's not poisonous in the way... And the last three...
Not on this subject, anyway.
No, Labour has its own own allocation of poison. But the last three Conservative Prime Ministers have fallen over Europe, and I suspect the fourth will as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet against the fifth, sixth and seventh. But let's look now towards Beijing, where scrutinising the runes scattered by the latest Communist Party Congress does not require a magnifying glass. Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the party and President of China, arrived at the conference already the most powerful man in the country and left it even more so. Having been paid the supreme compliment of having his personal philosophy, Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for the new era... That'll look good on the T-shirts, incorporated into the party's constitution. The only previous leader so honoured was Mao Zedong, arguably an unhappy precedent. Jeffrey, is this getting a bit personality culty at this point?
Well, I think China's always been a bit personality culty in this respect, and certainly in regimes that proclaim themselves to be Marxist, or in this case, proclaim themselves to be Leninist, there's always been an insistence that the great leader have a coherent political philosophy that guides the nation. And China is certainly one of the few societies in the world that really prides itself on taking political philosophy and political ideas seriously. And certainly the ideas that Xi has set out recently are ideas that paint a picture or a vision for China going forward the next 100 years. That paints a picture of a very assertive, muscular Chinese foreign policy, which certainly sits consistently with some of the things Xi has done. It paints a picture of deepening reforms in China with respect to anti-corruption. We know Xi has been very, very interested in cracking down on corruption. And it tells a story about a commitment to the rule of law, not a story about commitment to human rights, but a story about commitment to the rule of law. And so I think there are things to like, actually, about the picture we see, as well as certainly things to dislike.
Ivor, do we have a clear idea of, I mean, in a way that we could understand it outside China, of what his philosophy practically amounts to, what he actually wants?
You're struggling to say the words Jinpingism. Well, I think it's been quite clear over the last 2 years that one of the things he feels that has been, I won't say China's shortfall, but they have not been assertive enough on the international stage, and one looks at particularly what China has been doing in terms of the China Sea and its territorial disputes with Japan and the Philippines, there's clearly a more muscular foreign policy. I've spent some time working in China with journalists, and I'm always struck how Chinese communism is an important part of the philosophy of the ruling class, but actually Chinese nationalism is much stronger. Deep sense of resentment still at the West.
Have the two become broadly the same thing, though?
I think that's an interesting observation. I think, you see, Deng Xiaoping just wanted to build a strong capitalist economy, under him, who was second only to Mao in terms of the importance of thought. Under Deng, China did not play a global role in terms of diplomacy. Deng was much more interested in building up strong trade relations with the US and with Europe and so forth. I think here we're seeing this merger, and whether there's a positive side to this. Will Jinpingism, I'll just say Xi, will he feel empowered to intervene with his noisy neighbour North Korea? Or because the new China should play a role in terms of international diplomacy, or will he just keep his head down? I don't know, but it does seem to me that this is a new China that is not emerging, has emerged, and it's now got a name.
Jeffrey, on the subject of the international stage that Ivor mentioned there, does Xi Jinping and China in general see the present circus taking place in the White House as an opportunity?
That did occur to me. I would be skeptical about the idea that his philosophy has itself been impacted by the presence of Donald Trump. I suspect that the core ideas of his philosophy have been a long time in the making, and he and the people around him have put an awful lot of thought into this, and it's not just a sudden moment of political opportunism on the global stage. Still, I can't help but wonder if they're thinking, boy, did we come at a right time? Is this not a good time for a more assertive internationalist China to be on the rise? I mean, this slogan, China on the Rise, has been with us for a long time. But in terms of the opportunity for China to assert itself, it's certainly the kind of global retrenchment and isolationism we see coming out of the Trump administration, at least at the level of rhetoric, invites this kind of posture from China, to be sure.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Ivor Gaber, and Jeffrey Howard. Coming up next, the Bundestag reconvenes and wonders how to handle its new arrivals.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Ivor Gaber and Jeffrey Howard. Now, Germany's parliament, the Bundestag, has been meeting today for the first time since the general election of last month. It is a bigger parliament than previously, 709 MPs as opposed to the previous 631, though the consequent jostling for a seat is not the most urgent worry. The most pressing concern of the new Bundestag is what to do with and or about the 92 MPs returned by the German electorate belonging to Alternative for Deutschland, an unsavoury gaggle of far-right dingbats and crackpots. Jeffrey, I'm assuming we're in broad agreement on this. If one of you wants to make a case for AfD, you're welcome to. I'm not holding my breath. The AfD, Jeffrey, they won't be the official opposition. They are only the third biggest party, so the official opposition will be the Social Democrats. But how much of a nuisance can the AfD make of themselves?
I think they're going to be quite a nuisance. They're going to try to steer discussions toward the kinds of things that they care about. They're going to be talking about refugees. They're going to be talking about the alleged Islamification of Germany. They're going to be talking about crime and law and order issues. And they're going to try to hijack the debate, definitely. And I think the real question on our hands is, what's the most appropriate strategy for responding to that? And the principal worry I have is that it's tempting to just demonize them and call them neo-Nazis, as the 10,000 or so protesters in front of the Brandenburg Gate this week
did. Or crackpots and dingbats.
Crackpots and dingbats, right? But when you're in the parliament, I think the real question is, how do you respond to them in a way that doesn't change their minds? Because you're not going to change the minds of the people who are you know, elected for this party. But there's the question of the people who voted for them, who voted for them to send a message, who are angry, who are disenchanted, who are not avowed racists and neo-Nazis themselves, but felt that they had to do this in order to send a message to the elite and to the establishment. And I think the worry I have is that demonization of these people will serve to only energize their base.
Just to follow that up, though, that this narrative of disenfranchised, left-behind folks sending the elites a message is a narrative we have heard in quite a few electorates in the last few years, most obviously in the United States. At what point are the elites and the establishment, if you like, entitled to say to the left-behind folks, you know what, you're wrong, you're just wrong?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what should be said. And I think the strategic question is how you say that in a way that's effective and that actually moves people. And there's plenty of social scientific evidence that shows that when you just tell people that they're idiots, that they're stupid, that they're racist, that they're wrong, that they become even more sedimented and ingrained in their views. So the strategic question is, how do you engage with them in a way that begins that is able to perhaps reach their voters and move them away from some of their views. And part of it, I think, is recognizing the grievances and the worries that move people to vote for these parties in the first place and say, right, you have these worries about refugees. We're recognizing that you have these worries, and here's how we're going to respond to these worries, and doing so honestly, but doing so in a way that's respectful of people as well.
Ivor, what if those grievances are basically just that I don't like foreigners and I wish it was still 1958?
Yeah, there is a problem of moving on to their agenda. I recognise that there are legitimate concerns, but it's a difficult, not to say dangerous, game. I mean, the experience in the UK, admittedly not at parliamentary level, but at local authority level, where we have had our share of dingbats and what was the other thing?
Crackpots
and dingbats from the far right elected, the BNP and the National Front and others, is that they tend to implode. In the nicest possible way. They cannot cope with formal politics, with opposition, with resolutions, and they're dysfunctional, they don't serve the interests of their constituents, and they don't get re-elected. I don't know the exact figures, but for example, there was a London council, Barking and Dagenham, which had quite a significant number of far-right councillors who didn't managed to survive one term. They either resigned or they defected or they didn't get re-elected. So I'm not sure, Jeff. I totally agree about playing on their wicket or going to their agenda. My own philosophy or my own tactics would be to let them enough rope to hang themselves.
The thing is, of course, Geoffrey, that far-right entryists don't often implode in a single term, and fairly obvious historical parallels where Germany is concerned have been drawn and will continue to be drawn, specifically about the election of 1930. Are those parallels any help at all, or is Germany and the world now so completely different from what it was then that this isn't really something worth thinking about?
Well, as Ivor said earlier, never say never, but I'm pretty confident of the fact that Germany is one of the most stable liberal constitutional democracies in the world, which is actually an astonishing achievement, given how recently they were a genocidal totalitarian dictatorship.
It is an extraordinary
revolution. And so I don't think that the AfD represents a deep decay in German society that's going to undermine liberal democracy. But I do think that there is genuine xenophobia in Germany, just like there's genuine xenophobia in all liberal democracies. And what we need to do is combat it as effectively as possible.
I think we're at a particular moment in time which favoured the AfD because of the million migrant immigrants that the German government allowed to get in. I would hazard a guess in the prediction business, careful, but in 4 years' time, when those migrants have been integrated, and of course the Germans and the rest of the EU have put up the shutters, it will be no longer the potent issue it is at the moment. It's sure going to be an issue.
It is nevertheless difficult to imagine that those 4 years will elapse without other terrorist attacks in Germany or elsewhere in Europe.
Yeah, but it depends how the politicians handle those terrorist attacks. I mean, we've had terrorist attacks in London, significant terrorist attacks in London. We have a mayor of Asian origin, but the Labour Party at the last election, he's a Labour MP, he's a Labour mayor, did significantly better in London than it did elsewhere. In other words, there wasn't blowback from these terrorist attacks on the political party in charge of the polity. So my view is it depends on how the politicians handle it. And I do think that they can avoid the approbation from those attacks falling on the Muslim community.
OK, well, finally tonight, another story confirming that the advent of social media has rendered pretty much everyone under the age of 40 forever ineligible to hold public office. Jared O'Mara, a British MP with the opposition Labour Party, has resigned from the UK Parliament's Women and Equalities Committee after racist, sexist and homophobic contributions to online message boards made some years ago were unearthed. O'Mara is now being further investigated over alleged abusive behaviour, which he denies, towards a woman in a Sheffield nightclub earlier this year. Geoffrey, should he lose the whip over this? And to listeners in non-parliamentary democracies, that means effectively cast into outer darkness by the parliamentary Labour Party.
I think they should look into it. I think that it wouldn't be crazy to make him lose the whip over this. If you look at the comments he made, they weren't just off-color jokes. They were the expressions of what seemed to me to be deeply homophobic views. Now, it's possible he's changed his mind over the years. He's had some kind of enlightenment, in which case he better have a press conference soon and tell us what this enlightenment has been and really try to convince us persuasively that he has changed his mind. Because these comments suggest someone that really does hold some kind of animus, or at least used to hold some kind of animus toward his fellow citizens who are gay. And I think his constituents in the country generally has the right to be disturbed about that.
I mean, the line being taken by his defenders, Ivor, is one which I do have a certain amount of sympathy. It's basically, you know, let he who got through his entire 20s without ever saying, doing or thinking anything boorish, obnoxious or stupid cast the first stone. But as Jeffrey points out, a lot of which he posted, I mean, it is fairly obnoxious.
I think fairly is rather kind to him, actually. I think it was totally obnoxious. I do think there are two separate issues. Should he have resigned from the Women's and Equalities Committee? Absolutely no question. Should he have the Labour whip withdrawn? Well, classically, the Labour Party is, quote, holding an inquiry. I think it's a really difficult one because, as you say, firstly, once people's social media and other histories are probed, there's not that many people who would emerge totally scot-free. But on the other hand, according to MPs, particularly women MPs who attended a meeting last night of the Parliamentary Labour Party, the group of MPs, they were very convinced by his conversion, if you like, his realisation that as a 21-year-old he was totally wrong. And I do think that we have to allow people to see they've made a mistake and change, you know, sinners and repenting and all of that. So I think it's a really difficult one. I would be much more comfortable with it had his remarks not been quite so obnoxious. I would say, well, you know, but there is a quality to those remarks which is difficult to ignore. I don't know.
It is an odd one, and I tend to agree with that. I'm not sure what to think either. Jeffrey, he has already said, and doubtless we will hear a tiresome amount more of this, that it was a difficult time in his life, that he has been on a journey. How could he actually practically demonstrate that? Assuming that's all true, and assuming that he is now looking back at these remarks that he posted on various forums, you know, through fists balled up in his eyes, feeling absolutely mortified, is an apology enough? Is there an actual practical gesture he could make?
So I think he's going to need to think of something. I think he needs to do more than just communicate apology, because anyone can say the words. I think he needs to do some kind of penance to show us that he really, really means it. What that might look like is a really, really interesting question. I mean, I think there's a tendency when we're talking about issues like this to think, well, should he be held accountable for saying this or not? And we tend to think, well, if the answer is he should be held accountable, that means he should lose the whip. Maybe he should resign from his post entirely. But I think there's a difference between holding accountable and ruining his life as a result. So holding him accountable means insisting that he explain to us why he did what he did, apologize for what he's done, and then demonstrate in some way that he's properly reformed. And if he does that adequately, then I think we have a reason to forgive him. And I think that's the flip side of holding someone accountable, that if they submit to the being held accountable and they express their apology appropriately, then they might be eligible for forgiveness in this case. And I think having more forgiveness in our public culture would mean that more people who have made mistakes in the past would be willing to get involved in politics.
Would that apply to Harvey Weinstein? I mean, I'm wondering.
Well, this brings to the question which I was wondering about, that Omar is only 35. Is there an age past which a man just does not change? Or cannot change? I mean, this was, Donald Trump, about a year ago after the release of the infamous take, I think, tried to write it off as the youthful indiscretion of a man of 62.
Yeah. I do think, actually, to be fair to the MP, he just posted offensive remarks. Weinstein did offensive things, and I do think there's a big difference.
Indeed.
The other issue is, I just wonder if this matter has received much more publicity in the wake of Weinstein and women revealing the amount of sexual harassment they've suffered. I just think, you know, that's the dominant narrative at the moment, and he's unfortunate, if you like, that he's just caught it. But I think you do have to accept the fact, the right of people to say, I was wrong, I have changed. I think it would be a very harsh society if we said nothing. It's inadmissible. That's it. You're doomed. The right to, we were discussing earlier off air, the right to be forgotten. The right to be forgotten, which is an interesting one. Has he got the right to be forgotten, or not him to be forgotten, but his past sins to be forgotten?
I was saying to somebody just last night, annoyed though I am to have reached the age I apparently have, I cannot overstate my relief that I got to spend my entire teens, 20s and almost all of my 30s without anybody knowing what was social media actually was. That brings us to the end of today's show. Ivor Gaber and Geoffrey Howard, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900. It's our design show, Section D. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That will be 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you very much for listening.